I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Carol is the name of Todd Haynes' new movie about a love affair between two women. It's set in the early 1950s and is based on the novel The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith. Carol Aird, played by Cate Blanchett, is a wealthy, unhappily married housewife who is drawn to Thérèse Bellavette, played by Rooney Mara, who works in the toy department of an upscale department store. After Carol leaves her gloves at the store, Thérèse returns them, and Carol asks her out to lunch. Here's a scene at the restaurant.
So I'm sure you thought it was a man who sent you back your gloves.
I did. Thought it might have been a man in the ski department.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm delighted. I doubt very much I would have gone to lunch with him.
Oh, your perfume.
Yes.
It's nice.
Thank you. Harge bought me a bottle years ago, before we were married, and I've been wearing it ever since.
Harge is your husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, technically, we're divorcing.
I'm sorry.
Don't be.
Todd Haynes is a writer, director of a number of award-winning films, including Far From Heaven, which received 4 Academy Awards, I'm Not Here, Velvet Goldmine, Safe Poison, and the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Todd Haynes, a great pleasure and congratulations on the film.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you.
It actually received 4 nominations.
Oh, sorry. Nominations.
We like to think that there were awards, but, you know.
In my mind, they were awards.
Right.
What I loved even listening to that clip is just hearing those two voices.
Yeah.
Cate Blanchett's kind of smoky older voice and this young voice from Rooney Mara.
Yeah. No, it really is, aside from being a lesbian romance, a story of lesbian love set in a very unlikely time and place, it's a May-December romance. And the challenges that that brings and their different sort of economic standings and social statuses compound the challenges that they face as a couple.
When this book was published, it was published in 1952, and the cover read, the novel of a love society forbids.
Right.
About forbidden love.
And yeah.
And I also read that this was a bestseller in many ways.
Well, it was a small press, underground small press that ultimately published The Price of Salt. Patricia Highsmith shopped it around with her leading publisher. So I think Harper's had just published her first novel, Strangers on a Train. But no one wanted to touch it. You know, and it remained a sort of, and she did it under a pseudonym, Claire Morgan, during much of her lifetime. And she had this very prolific career that established her as one of our leading crime novelists, highly respected novelists in that field. And she did finally republish it as Carol before she died in the 1980s. So it got to sort of come out, basically.
Did you want to tell the story because I hope I'm not giving too much away, but it has a kind of a happy ending?
Well, that is what, kind of characterizes or distinguishes The Price of Salt from a lot of the sort of traditional lesbian fiction that had preceded it, that always sort of end with a punitive or punishing, resolution and to this forbidden escapade. And this book did not do that. And it reflected Patricia Highsmith's life. She was a lesbian, and it's the only really autobiographical novel that I know of that she wrote. Except for, she wrote her very last novel was also about gay life in the 1980s.
Wow.
And I only heard about this recently. So I think it's a lesser known piece of her work. But for the most part, Price of Salt was a beloved and unique exception for her.
What's so interesting is watching this film in 2015 when gays and lesbians can be married, and here's this love affair where people have secrets, they have to sneak around, they can't use, words that other people in love can use. It's all kind of coded.
Yes. Oh, extremely so. The profound, even further lack of lesbian representation was even more a factor of this particular time. But what I loved about the novel when I first read it, and it was to the surprise and shock of all my dear lesbian friends, I didn't know it when it came to me as a novel. And And I just was so taken with how it's ultimately a story of just falling in love and how when you are in that state, it's all told through the point of view of Therese, the younger character played by Rooney Mara in the film. You know, you feel like you're inventing it for the first time. You feel like there's no language for your experiences. You know, you feel like there's no classification for your particular desire. And that's how she feels. And yet, in many ways, she's also right. There was a the historical context also re-echoes all of that as true. But that just only – I just think that just – that was almost secondary to the fact that this was a universal experience.
When we meet her, she's working in the doll department. You did a movie about Karen Carpenter with Barbie dolls.
Yes.
I don't know if you had a certain affinity for dolls or not, or the doll department of a department store.
Yeah, it echoed back to an early film, something I did when I first moved to New York. And really the first film of mine that people actually wanted to see, or that I could show in, you know, experimental film festivals. And then it was reviewed in the Village Voice and Art Forum. And in those days, that was a really big deal, especially for a, you know, unknown filmmaker. And that sort of started my filmmaking visibility.
But do you have a particular interest in dolls?
Well, with Superstar, you know, I'd come.
And that's the Karen Carpenter
story. It was sort of a narrative experiment. It was an experiment that I wanted to sort of see if it would work, where you would follow a well-known genre that audiences know what it looks like and how it moves, and you would just replace actors with dolls and see if we can affect the same emotional connections to the material and to the subject matter that we do with other films, as if to say that it's as much the formal traditions and the language of filmmaking that triggers, and that the emotions are ours. The emotions aren't necessarily that there's a real person once upon a time on the other side of the camera, but that we bring them to life in the process of watching. And so I wanted to do a film with dolls before I even knew what the film would be about. And then I was hearing a Carpenter song one day, and I went, yeah, oh man. Put these two things together. And I was working with a dear friend who actually lives in Philadelphia, my friend Cynthia Schneider, who went to college with me at Brown, and we wanted to do a project together. She wanted to do a movie with pets, and I wanted to do a movie with dolls.
And
the dolls went out. Once we heard Karen singing to us, then that cinched the deal.
Well, going back to this film, Carol, and even going back to Rooney Mara's performance, she is like a little girl. I mean, when we first meet her working in this department store, working again in the toy department, she has a little jumper on, and she has a little Santa Claus hat on, and she sounds like a little girl.
Yeah.
And innocent in many ways.
Very funny. Rooney just sent me a photo, just texted me a photo of herself, maybe age 4. She said, look, I have the Therese haircut. And did. She's a little more blonde than she is today. Beautiful little kid. but yeah, she's coming into focus, this character. She's sort of somebody who doesn't really know who she is yet. And she describes that in the movie sort of in the way that she says, I don't know how to say no.
Yes.
You know, she accepts everything and she has a boyfriend, but she accepts the advances of another guy in one scene. And then she's immediately enthralled by this older woman that she meets at the doll counter.
Yeah.
But what you really see in the course of really what is only about a 6-month span in the film is you really watch this character grow up, get hurt, develop kind of a thicker skin and defenses in the world like we all do, and change before your very eyes.
When I first saw Cate Blanchett and she plays Carol, there was something a little predatory about her. I mean, she's of a different class. She's very wealthy. She wears this beautiful fur coat. She kind of sashays in and out of rooms, kind of in control. And at least in my mind, when I first met her, I thought she was a little dangerous.
Mm. You know, it's funny. I think while you're watching Carol as a contemporary audience, you're also examining the codes and the language of the times. And And you're sort of reading all of these things sort of as a sort of path or a maze of possible, you know, movement that could bring two people together in an unlikely time and place. And it's very much like what the person falling in love is doing. They're reading every sign for what it portends for their fate, you know, in love. And you find watching Carol, and it's even in the clip that you open with, that you think, oh, wow, she invited this girl to lunch. And then you go, when Carol says, well, I wouldn't have invited the guy who runs the ski department. And you realize, oh, of course, it's completely acceptable, socially permissible for an older woman to invite a younger woman to lunch, an innocent. But if it was a man that she invited to lunch, it would be a completely different thing. So it's just funny to watch, you know, to navigate an unusual language in many ways, both from internally and externally, as they pursue each other.
Do you think there's some parallel between this kind of relationship, this kind of forbidden love of the 1950s, and people having an affair? With an affair, I mean,
you
sort of can't be honest about it.
Sure.
There's a lot of sneaking around.
Absolutely, of course. I mean, that's why I just kept finding all of these things about it that were so basic when I read the book and read the first Phyllis Nagy's first draft of Carol that came to me. And I felt like, wow, this is really something that even before it becomes specifically about lesbian desire or, you know, whatever your sex or your sexual orientation, this is something we've all known.
There is a scene, again, hopefully not giving too much away here, but there is a scene where the two of them make love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really beautiful scene. And I think at that point in the story, you sense this longing, this fear, this excitement, all of that sort of comes together.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is shot, it seemed like, looking down on them.
Mm-hmm. We're sort of hovering
exactly
over them. And there are some shots that are literally upside down to kind of suggest that this moment, which we have been building up to in the film, it's almost a suspense film in a certain way as to when and how are these two women going to consummate their feelings for each other. But where you feel like the gravity has completely unearthed itself and been dislodged and that Therese's world is being literally rocked at this moment and inverted and new possibilities are forming.
We're almost having a break here, but there are times when you're not sure whose arm is that? I mean, I wasn't exactly saying that in the theater, but just they're so intertwined, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Todd Haynes about his new film. It's called Carol and it will open later this year. He's writer, director of a number of award-winning films, including Far From Heaven, I'm Not Here, Velvet Goldmine, Safe Poison, Mildred Pierce, which was an HBO miniseries. And we were also talking about the Karen Carpenter story as well. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain talking with Todd Haynes about making movies. He's made a bunch of them, and he's got a new film called Carol. It's a story of a love affair between two women set in the 1950s, starring Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And if you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And we'll be playing clips from some of his other films just a little bit later on in the program. Many of these shots in this film you see through kind of grimy windows, whether it's a taxi cab or someone's house.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of them. And I was curious about the thinking that went into that.
Yeah. Well, very differently from the world that I explored in an earlier film set in the 50s that I made called Far From Heaven, this 50, which was really the full Eisenhower era, you know, and reflected the Hollywood sort of soundstage language of filmmaking and melodrama. Carol We were looking much more at the sort of historical research from the period, the photojournalism and the art photography from the time. And for people who do know the work of the amazing photographer who passed away very recently named Saul Leiter, who was a New York-based color photographer and abstract expressionist painter, they will see the influence in the kinds of shots that you described. He loves shooting through glass and windows and precipitation and having that sort of indeterminate sense of temperature from inside a cafe to outside of a snowy New York City. And that was clearly one of the influences. And I guess we kept thinking of the fact that when you're looking through things and there's obstructions in the way, it kind of, you know, foregrounds the act of looking itself and makes you think about who's looking at who. And reveals that whenever we're in a movie, someone's making that decision for you. But here, hopefully, you keep thinking about Therese and the person who, and later Carol looking at Therese, because their sort of positions change through the course of the story. But that it's really about point of view and love.
It's set in a very specific time, so it's not the Eisenhower era.
Yeah.
It is after World War II, so it's those couple of years before, 1953, when Eisenhower becomes the president.
Exactly.
A very specific time and place. And you mentioned Far From Heaven with those, you know, rich oranges and greens.
Mm.
The palette in this film is a little
muted.
Dirtier.
It is.
Or
soiled.
Sort of beaten up looking.
Yeah. Because along with Saul Leiter, we were looking at photojournalists, publishing in Life magazine and looking at this great color photography from the period. And some of that palette comes from the color processes of the time. But the other thing that we found that was kind of cool was that because in our film, unlike the book, Therese is an aspiring photojournalist. So she's also sort of learning how to frame the world, which is another reason why the act of looking becomes a theme. A lot of these great photographs that we were seeing were by female photographers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Ruth Orkin, Helen Levitt, Esther Bubbly were known and published photographers during the time. Vivian Meyer's work would more recently be discovered as being a chronicler of this period. She worked in black and white, but she was taking pictures in Chicago, in New York, all through this time. So it was really cool to see that women were also very actively behind the lens in the research that was coming to us.
There are scenes where someone is wearing, perhaps it's Carol wearing a bright red coat or bright red lipstick. I mean, there were times where I just felt like, wow, that's an extraordinary color.
It's almost underscored by the relative dinginess of the place and the color. And you'll see this in Saul Leiter's work, where you'll see a snowscape through a muted glass and interruptions of the frame and filtered information. And then there'll be a bright red umbrella in the corner of the frame. It's such a, like, gorgeous stroke of eccentric color. And it was something Sandy Powell, an amazing costume designer who this is the third film we've done together, multi-Academy Award winning designer and great friend, looked at and thought about in terms of like how to have a kind of more monochromatic color palette for most of the clothes. But then sometimes Carol will wear gray or beige, but there'll be that sort of salmon colored scarf or a brooch or the lipstick that will be the little punctum, the little detail that cuts through.
Seems like music is important to you. I mean, looking at some of your past films, and certainly in this one, it's this sort of gorgeous, rich score of strings.
Mm. Yeah. And a lot of woodwinds, I think, in this case with Carter's score. Carter Burwell did the score for Carol. He had also done the score for Mildred Pierce, which he won the Emmy for. And I worked with him first on Velvet Goldmine, where he did some additional score elements to a mostly song-based soundtrack. But Carter is probably best known for doing the scores to every single Coen Brothers film from the very beginning and many, many other fantastic indie movies and studio films. He's so gifted. He's such a smart and considered and acutely sort of his process is so focused and lovely. And the whole evolution of the language of the music is one that we kind of, you know, go through together from the earliest cuts that we have to show him. I even play Carter our little mixed track of songs that I use as research, just so we can hear like the music of the time and the kind of arrangements that were coming out at that time. It starts to sort of determine or create a path of like what kind of musical voices he might put together for the finished score.
I noticed that you've worked with Christine, is it
Vachon?
Vachon on a number of films. Cate Blanchett has been in a couple of your films. Ed Lachman is the DP.
Exactly.
You like working with people that you know?
I do. I mean, you develop relationships and they vary from film to film, and sometimes people aren't available or things change. But yeah, it feels great to be able, because each of these the four films I've done with Ed so far, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan inspired film, Mildred Pierce, the miniseries that was shown on HBO, and Carol, are all so very different in tone and temperament that each time, you know, he's asked to do something quite, we kind of start from scratch, you know, and he's a real artist that way. And Judy Becker designed I'm Not There, and she designed Carol, but I've also worked with a couple other designers. So yeah, there's a little collective of people that I do enjoy.
It's interesting you had to go to Cincinnati to shoot a film that was set in New York, right?
Oh, it was great though. It was so great. It was a revelation, first of all, I'd been in Cincinnati in the early 90s, I think. I hadn't been back since then. And it was prompted by a newly generous tax rebate for film production in Ohio State.
That helps.
That always helps. And that's often the way you at least begin the search. And so we looked at Cleveland first, and it wasn't quite right. And then we went to Cincinnati, and it was such a unspoiled city of architectural integrity. And, you know, we literally shot some scenes that were using existing signage on the streets of Cincinnati today for 1952 New York City.
Wow.
And that's just so rare these days, you know, where the gentrification hasn't completely, you know, swept all of that stuff away. But everybody really dug it. Like Cate and Rooney just loved, I think because we felt like we were almost creating our own world and we could get away from familiar places and conjure this early 50s world ourselves. And we really felt like it was our backlot. It was our canvas to paint on.
There was a quote that I liked. Rooney Mara said that when you're in love, your mind works like a criminal's mind, that you're sort of sizing everything up all the time.
Yeah.
Checking things out.
That's something that we, you know, took note of in Patricia Highsmith's novel, because she's known as a crime writer. And yet in The Price of Salt, we're locked inside Therese's head the way you're locked inside the head of Ripley or her more typical criminal subjects in her other novels. And yet I just found like we all just thought it was so interesting how that those mechanisms are the same and how you're reading every sign and every indication of your fate, basically. And the world is a sort of place of just potent symbols to decode constantly.
Keep you on edge, doesn't it?
It does, but it means like it pathologizes love the way she you know, the way it's normally the criminal mind that she actually makes something that we all can imagine entering. But in this case, we've all been in that tunnel of love before.
That's Todd Haynes, who's joining us in studio in this hour of Radio Times, and his new film, Carol, will be opening later this year. He's also done a number of award-winning films, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Velvet Goldmine, Safe Poison, the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce. I do want to play a scene from I'm Not There, and this is your film 2007 about Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is played by six different actors. And in this this scene, Cate Blanchett plays one of those portrayals of Dylan, a guy named Jude Quinn, answering some questions from the British journalist at a London press conference. Let's give it a listen.
Well, is it your belief then that folk music has perchance failed to achieve its goals with the Negro cause or the cause of peace?
You know, saying cause of peace is just like saying was like a hunk of butter. You know, I don't know how you can listen to anybody who wants you to believe is dedicated to the hunk and not the butter.
I'm not sure I follow.
You know, I didn't come out of some cereal box. There's no one out there who's ever going to be converted by a song. There's no Phil Oaks song that's going to keep a movement moving, you know, or a picket line picketing. His songs act as a personal conscience. Like burning a draft card or burning yourself. Doesn't do a damn thing. Except disassociate you and your audience from all the evils of the world. I refuse to be disassociated from that.
And that's a scene from I'm Not There, our guest's film, a fractured look at Bob Dylan. And that's Cate Blanchett playing a version of Bob Dylan. What I love so much about that, it sounds just like a Dylan song. I mean, the way she speaks sounds like a Dylan song.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, she was so attentive, as all the actors were, to all the research and all of the unique and distinct phases of Dylan's life and career, particularly in the 1960s. But also, these quotes come directly from these extraordinary interviews that Dylan gave in 66, where he really was toying with the journalistic sort of, you know, agenda. And he, in a way, he was answering the questions, but he was also undermining the entire process in the most brilliant way, using that kind of crazy language that you also hear in his classics from that time, like Blonde on Blonde. So it's just the most, you know, Cate still talks to me today about doing interviews for Carol and being like, just that she had done the research of Dylan's interviews in the 60s for I'm Not There, that it changes the entire, you look at the whole process from a completely different light.
And that's Todd Haynes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Was that the first time you had worked with her in a film?
That was, yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, it looks like you have a good synergy with her.
Well, I'm proud to say that we've done two pretty memorable outings. We've had two pretty memorable outings together in two extreme – I mean, you couldn't have asked for two more different characters for an actor to play, a man and a woman. And you know, Dylan at this particular moment of his various incarnations, because this was really about not even the Dylan of Don't Look Back, the famous Penny Baker documentary that's black and white. And, you know, from the outside, people might say, oh, yeah, that looks like the same to me. But by 66, he had plugged in electric, and he had all of a sudden had the energy and the force and the violence of a backing band to kind of challenge the expectations of the folk loving audience that were expecting something quite different from him.
And we're furious.
And we're furious, exactly.
Broke the rules,
that he broke
right?
the orthodoxy of the folk, you know, whatever faith. And he was clearly, as many people were in those days, because they were legal, on amphetamines. He had dropped all this weight. He was jumping around. And he developed this strange androgyny that was very much his own. It wasn't the androgyny that you would connect with a David Bowie, as I had explored in an earlier film about the glam rock era in the early 70s. It was almost like he was a Patti Smith precursor, you know. But I felt like the shock value of that look and sound and volume has sort of been drained over time because it's so well known, this period of Dylan's life. And I needed to have a little element of shock reinserted. And I thought, if a woman played the part, you know, and you felt that strange uncanniness of the body and voice and the hair and the skinny, you know, that it might be closer to what people really felt in the day. And so she did that and a lot more with that role.
I mean, it seems like you have such an affinity for telling women's stories or stories from a woman's point of view. Is it because you feel like you understand women, or they are a mystery to you, or some?
I got women all figured out, man. I've always.
Well, pray tell, explain who we are.
No. I do feel like I've maybe learned everything I know from women, and
really?
Yeah, I do. I've always had women as, you know, from my mom, my grandmother to you know, strong and influential people in my life from the very beginning. To just the dearest, most sort of formative close friendships with women from the youngest age on. Mm. But I also think that, you know, women's stories in film describe our lives more because they're usually they're characterized by limits and harder and choices that have to be made because they are the ones who raises our kids and sort of maintain the integrity of the family and the home and they have maybe more limited range of freedoms than are afforded men historically. And so they're bound by social constraints that that we all are bound by. But stories about men and the fantasies and the, you know, the prerogatives of men are often these genres of escape and discovery and infinite, you know, sort of lack of boundaries. And they're great. And we love the Western and we love the noir and we love all of these more ungirded genres. But female stories, I just think, bring up issues that really, you know, continue to remind me of my life.
Well, we're almost having a break here. I saw a quote, I guess it was in the New York Times, about Mildred Pierce. Stories about women in houses are the real stories of our lives. They really tell what all of us experience in one way or another because they're stories of families and love and basic relationships and disappointments. But the idea of, and you do, you often place women in houses.
Yeah, well, that's often where, you know, we think of women residing. Mildred Pierce is so interesting because it's also a story about the workplace and about women taking the lead in the Depression era, particularly this one remarkable character. And the men are kind of passive characters and sort of a bit sort of wounded during the economic trials of the Depression. But you see the woman, the mother, stepping out, and you see how the workplace becomes this manifestation of the American, you know, middle-class dream that she wants to give to her daughter.
Well, I want to play a clip after this very short break. Again, Todd Haynes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, writer-director. He's got a new film, Carol, which is opening here in Philadelphia, across the country, a little bit later on this year. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you just joined us, our guest is Todd Haynes. He is a director. He's also a writer. A number of award-winning films, including Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Velvet Goldmine, Safe, Poison, the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce. And he's got a new film coming out later this year called Carol. And it's based on a novel that was written in the early 1950s, starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, about two women who fall in love with each other. Well, I do want to play a clip from this Mildred Pierce from the HBO miniseries. It stars starred Kate Winslet as Mildred Pierce. She's a divorced mother struggling to support her family in the 1940s. She's got an ambitious and ungrateful daughter, Veda. Let's give it a listen.
Haven't I given you everything you've ever wanted? If there was something you needed, couldn't you have come to me first instead of resorting to this? To blackmail? You want to know why? I'll tell you why. With enough money, I can get away from you. You. And your pie wagons and chickens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from Glendale and its dollar days and furniture factories and women that wear uniforms and men that wear smocks. From every rotten, stinking thing that even reminds me of this place. Or you.
And that's a scene from Mildred Pierce, the HBO miniseries of a couple of years ago. Kate Winslet and Rachel Wood. Why did you want to tell this story?
You know, my good friend in Portland, Oregon, where I live these days, John Raymond, is a writer and has worked on a bunch of Kelly Reichert's amazing movies of late. He had been saying, have you ever read the James M. Cain original novel, Mildred Pierce? Mm-hmm. And he'd never seen the Michael Curtiz film version with Joan Crawford, right? And that's what I knew of Mildred Pierce, of course, film school and or learning it from school in college. And love that film and think it's an amazing, unique film from its time. But I finally got around to reading the book. This was August of 2008, just as the financial markets were starting to tumble and the banks were failing. And I'm reading this book about the Depression and really spanning the entire decade of the Depression in ways that movie I didn't remember doing. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like, wow, this is like now. This is today. We're looking at what's happening right now in this country, and how great. And also, that film had. There were just things about what happens to Vida and this whole aspect of the plot where she becomes a coloratura soprano and surprises her mother with this amazing ability that weren't in the film either. So it just felt like an opportunity to really go back to the novel and share it in a long form. And I'd never really done that before, so that was sort of a new experience. And I brought John Raymond on board, and we adapted the novel together.
What do you like as a director?
Am I
kind of a hands-on guy?
I'm a hands-on guy.
Do you have very clear ideas about what you want from your actors?
I do, although... I'd say I have a very clear idea of what the sort of style of the film is and the language of the film is, and it changes from film to film. But all of those ideas inform the actors and every other creative partner in the film. I think I can say I pick really, really great actors to come on board with these projects.
That helps.
And the rest is them. I mean, really, it's these amazing people who, you know, I've heard people say, you know, I've had a really hard time with this one actor, or I can't think of a single relationship I've had with an actor that's been difficult. That goes for day players and small parts and the people you sometimes cast in the cities you're in. But having the privilege of working with Kate Winslet on Mildred Pierce, of working with Kate Blanchett, and of working with Julianne Moore, to name just a few of the people I've worked with and have continued to work with, has been just such a privilege. And because they really care about the language of the movie. And what the point of view is, and what where the camera is, and what it's showing, and what it's not showing, and that informs their performance. It informs what their bodies are doing within the frame. You know, they have a consummate vision of the medium, and I just think that's something audiences don't always necessarily think actors, you know, bring to their roles.
But that's what you look for. I mean, clearly, you look for that as an actor,
and I think I just realize how much that helps them. To share that with them, and it's specific. I think specificity helps. When you really do have a ground plan, then your creative partners feel like there's a foundation, and then they can really leap off and you know, surprise you and do all kinds of amazing things. And all of those details really matter. And most of my films are period films, so every prop, every costume, every set is sort of a decision. And that's true for contemporary set movies as well, but you really have to be cognizant of every element in a period film. And they all are saying something about the time and the place.
And we're talking with Todd Haynes in this hour of Radio Times, talking about making movies. He's made a bunch of them, including Carol that we've been talking about, his new film, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Velvet Goldmine, Safe Poison. And we just played a clip from Mildred Pierce from the HBO miniseries. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I know you've been asked this before, you've said this before, but I thought it was so interesting that as a three-year-old you saw Mary Poppins, and that is a film that has really, it seems like it has stayed with you or meant a lot to you as a little kid, seeing that film.
Well, I
don't want to overstate it.
Well, no, it's hard for me to separate whether it was just the first film I saw that made, or... And I think it's a combination of all of these things, that film itself was such a powerful, synesthetic, you know, full experience. And yet this was also an extraordinary film.
Yeah.
And it fed the imagination in so many ways. but it induced in me some bizarre obsessive reaction where I kind of needed to like respond to what I saw, that experience, by, you know, I guess, repeating it. It's some probably Freudian pattern of you know, repetition,
woman,
compulsion,
guess.
And a strong woman.
A domestic life.
But no, even at the time, just being a kid and drawing pictures of Mary Poppins and having act out the scenes and get my mom to put on a hat and stick flowers on it. And, you know, like I needed to kind of repeat that powerful initial experience. And maybe that I've just been doing that ever since.
You also seem to be, we were talking earlier about sort of making movies about women or from a woman's perspective, but you also seem drawn to the 1950s. And I don't think you were old enough to have lived through the 50s, but it must mean something to you as a period of our history.
It does. I guess every period I've explored means something, and I feel in some weird way it lets me kind of live through that period, and I get to sort of time travel myself and feel like I've touched it or something. But, you know, the 50s of Far From Heaven, which was inspired by the films of Douglas Sirk and the sort of high melodramas of that era, I found was a very different 50s from that of the early 50s that Carol is set in. And that the fact that Carol was set in the early 50s, it just came with the material. It wasn't something I brought to it. But I liked that it was this unusual time. And we talked about it a little bit earlier. It was before the Eisenhower era had really taken hold. And so it was really a period of transition and maybe even a period of possibility. It was, you know, I think as a country, we felt insecurity at the time and we wanted a strong, different kind of leader than Truman had been, and we wanted some sense of regulation in our lives and order, and a strong economy followed with that, and so all of those wishes were seemed to be granted, but maybe right before that happened was a moment of potential where something else might have happened as well.
Well, I do want to play a scene from Far From Heaven. This is the film you made in 2002, starring Julianne Moore as Kathy Whittaker, Douglas Quaid as her husband, Frank Whittaker, and sort of talking about this 50s mythology in a lot of ways, living this what looks like a perfect suburban life, but underneath there's some secrets, some struggles as well. Frank has fallen in love with another man, and in this emotional scene, he's telling his wife.
I've fallen in love with someone who wants to be with me. Kathy, I never knew what that felt. But I know that sounds so cruel, but oh God, Kathy, I tried. I tried so hard to make it go away. And I thought that I could do it for you and for the kids. But I can't. I can't. I can't.
Really, just a heartbreaking scene from Far From Heaven. It's such an incredible performance by Dennis Quaid.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's talking about, you know, he's in love, talking about things like conversion therapy, which today has been, you know, essentially discredited.
Yeah.
But was a treatment for this condition that he had. Right,
right. No, I mean, there was no other way of positing an alternative to this, to the sort of, you know, regimented conformist period that certainly it's maybe become the mythology of the 1950s, but it came out of truth, of course. You know, the interesting thing about, you know, what I tried to tackle, I guess, with this movie was that all three characters, Dennis Haysbert plays, is an African-American gardener who Julianne Moore meets, and there's an infatuation that develops between the two of them that's not even consummated. I mean, there's a hand on her shoulder that happens at the end of the movie, and it becomes sort of the moment of contact. And but he's somebody she can talk to in the midst of this perplexing experience with her husband. And it's also a bit of an homage to this extraordinarily beautiful film that Douglas Sirk made, his own favorite film of his career, called All That Heaven Allows, which was about a widow played by Jane Wyman who falls in love with a younger Rock Hudson. And it scandalizes the Hartford, the small town where they live. It's not Hartford. Far from heaven is Hartford. And even Rainer Werner Fassbinder, the great German director from the 1970s, fell in love with this film and adapted it in his own way in a movie called, that in English is called Ali Firitz the Soul, and did it very much in his own manner. But I was sort of comparing the relative. I wanted to create a little story where three people, you know, are so entangled in a way that just one person's step toward their needs creates a knot of pain where everybody suffers. And you know, Fassbinder once said about a Sirk film, he said, you know, you understand all of them, and all of them are right, but there's nothing we can do to help any of them unless we change the world. And he said, we all cried over the film because it's so hard to change the world. And that's really what Sirk's movies do, is they show you a world that needs to be changed, but the how it changes is really up to us. It's not something that the film is going to show you.
And that's Todd Haynes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. You were associated, or I guess called, you know, the one of the proponents or leaders of the new queer cinema of a couple of, I guess, decades ago. Do you think of yourself as a gay director now? I mean, is that, I'm thinking Brokeback Mountain, the movies that you have made that, you know, it seems to me appeals to a wide audience with really universal stories to tell.
Yes. I mean, not to make people think I made Brokeback Mountain. Film that we all loved and that I made. The thing about Brokeback Mountain that's so interesting in relation to Carol is, you know, when Brokeback Mountain came out, it was like, right, the love story genre. What all love stories need is a conflict that keeps the lovers from fulfilling their love, so that you end up yearning for them to get together and for that love to happen. But it needs boundaries, obviously, and obstacles. And it becomes harder to think of in the modern world. It becomes harder for us to come up with reasons why two people can't be together. So that movie was set in the past and set in a very unexpected place in time where these actors or these men fall in love. And it rekindled the genre because of that, for those reasons. And I think Carol does some of the same things. At that time, the new queer cinema had a specific context that made a lot of sense to me. And I really did, because of the AIDS epidemic and what was sort of fueling these films, that made a lot of sense. I don't know that that's still the context in which I make my work.
Yeah. Well, things have changed, and it's been such a pleasure, Todd Haynes. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure for me.
Pleasure for us. And again, writer-director, his new film, Carol, opening later this year. And we're going to be playing some music to close us out, because he's working on, sometime in the near future, a film about Peggy Lee. And this is Why Don't You Do It Right.
You had a plan in Monday, 1922. You let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right, like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right, like some other men do? Get out of here, get me some money too. If you had prepared 20